Hello, I'm Eddie Temple Morris.
And I'm Nick Hawkes.
We hope you've enjoyed the incredible array of guests that we've had so far, from Norman Cook and Gary Newman through Marianne Hobbs and Danny Rampling to the likes of Goldie and the DMC's Tony Prince. This time it's a legend in the drum and bass game, actually, and in the bass house game, DJ Zinc.
In the bass game, maybe, let's say. Or let's just say a legend.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, Zinc's great, and I really enjoyed this conversation, and there's a lot of great music coming up, but it's kind of, as usual, it's a sort of tasters of the tracks. You're not going to hear the tracks in full here. If you want to hear them in full, Deezer.com, and you can also find some special Trailblazers playlists from us and our guests right there.
So yeah, he's a real character. You're going to enjoy this one. DJ Zinc, let's begin.
Deezer Originals. Trailblazers, DJ Zinc.
Welcome, dear friends, to another episode of Trailblazers. My name is Eddie Temple Morris, and by my side, as ever, XL and Positiva Records founder Nick Hawkes. Together, each time, we light a warm and friendly fire and invite another dance music legend like Nick to chat to us by the fireside, to talk about the cultural fires they started, and to play some of the tunes that soundtrack their fascinating lives. This week's fire starter is UK electronic music hero, old school drum and bass legend, and more recently, breaks and, as he says, crack house supremo. Nick here calls him Ben, but we all know and love him as DJ Zinc. Ben, welcome to Trailblazers.
Hello, chaps.
Let me very, very well. Better for seeing you.
Light this fire and throw me on it, is yeah. What you were going to say. Oh, no.
I'm going to light the fire and hand over, as ever, to Nick to kick the proceedings off.
All right, Ben. So thank you so much for coming to join us. Really good to have you here.
Pleasure.
Take me back to the start. You're a kid.
Okay.
You know, when did you get into music?
Okay. The music in the house when I was growing up wasn't particularly relevant to what I do now. Let's put it that way. Although my mum can play the piano, and we had a piano in the house, so I played on it, although I didn't get very far. But I guess that was an introduction to music as a, you know, the difference between a C and a G or stuff like that. And then my mum listened to a lot of, she listened to maybe a bit of folk music. And she's quite religious, so maybe some religious music. So not very influential in terms of electronic music. But that's what was going on in my house.
Okay.
So,
and where was this?
This was in Forest Gate, just next to Stratford in East London.
Right.
So when I discovered radio, you can imagine I was quite excited to be given this new music that wasn't, you know, music that in hindsight, it's pretty rubbish. Sorry, Mum. I lived in East London, and pirate radio was available. And it's easy now to forget. You know, we've got all this stuff on demand. You can you can listen to whatever you want, whenever you want, pretty much anywhere in the world.
Yeah,
that is significantly different to when I was young, and I was so lucky because I lived in London. And so I turned on my radio and there was reggae, hip hop, dance music, all this, you know, all this stuff. And it was normal. I didn't realise that it was a pirate. I remember my mum telling me one day, oh, these are pirate radio stations, you're not allowed to listen to them. And I was like worried that the police would come because I was listening to it. I thought maybe they can tell that you are listening to it.
And how old were you at that time?
That was, I mean, that moment of fear, I was probably 9 or 10, you know, 7. You know, around about 10. Yeah.
This is very early. You were like into radio really, really young.
Well, I saved up half the money and bought a, you remember them little radios that were about, I suppose they're about 12 inches, about 10 inches wide, and they had a one cassette. You put one cassette and then a speaker onto the right of it.
I saved up
15 quid and my mum gave me the other 15 quid to have one of them. So, so then I was listening to music and I was able to curate or to decide what I was listening to rather than somebody else, you know, playing the music. So, yeah, so I think really when I got to more like about 13 was when I found sort of hip hop stuff, and hip hop was new then, and it was this, they were putting break beats and people were rapping over it, and it was just a totally new thing. And it's hard to imagine now that hip hop being new. I mean, it was this like revolutionary thing. It's like, this is, people saying this isn't music. this is the, you know, so, and yeah, so yeah, I loved it.
Tim Westwood was one of the trailblazers
exactly,
right
exactly.
then.
And Radio pushing, London, was, I think he was on.
Was it a pirate?
LWR,
I think.
He was on Kiss when it was a pirate.
Before that, I remember having a tape of him.
Yeah.
You know, and I could hardly afford cassettes.
That, he was the glass collector at Gossips, of course.
Absolutely.
That's how far back we want to go.
Oh, my God. And of course, yes, hip-hop was a massive challenge to the status quo at the time. It was just really dangerous music.
Yeah, and it was... I mean, I don't know if I was really... I wasn't aware of that. I just listened to it and thought, I really like this. And I think breakbeats, caught my ear. Mm. And that is... Yeah, so breaks, I think... was the thing that really caught me straight away with that. So I remember, and samples, you know, samples of like jazz records being over breakbeats and that, or different samples.
Like
I think that is
Sonic or something, that kind of
thing.
Yeah,
I remember there was one song that had an Ike Turner sample in it. And
right.
It just was this new thing. Mm, and it was
exciting.
I just liked it. And I was like, you know, so I remember then, and then around about the same time, Electro, remember the Crucial Electro compilations?
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of my friends would have the vinyl and we would record it onto my cassette so I could play it on my little cassette thing.
You're talking the street
exactly.
sounds?
Exactly, yeah.
With a big number?
Exactly. Yeah. So the first track really that I would like to play, which is a sort of great example of the... I mean, now it would sound, you know, dated, but at the time it was just revolutionary. It was like this totally different sound. And this is Nucleus Jam On It, and this is a track, this is just, you know, at the time it was so cutting edge, so this is a great example of what I was listening to when I was 12, 13.
Cool, let's check it.
Trailblazers, DJ Zinc. Up until the night you're down, and when you're bumping up, make sure you pass it around. Come on, let's go to work. We got what'll make your body jerk. We can throw your hands up in the air, shake your booty and scream, oh yeah, cause we are the Jam On Crew, and jamming on is how we do the do. We'll funk you up until you book it down, so come on, people.
So that was Nucleus, Jam On It, and that is a... Like I said, great example. That was breakdancing. So you
get the lino out and...
Well, I mean, not really. I came from Forest Gate in East London, and I think maybe we'd get a cardboard box and unpack it, but lino was too posh.
Yeah,
too posh for us.
It was luxury.
You know what I mean? I didn't come from... You know, the more I've travelled, the more I see what poverty is. But when I was a kid, we didn't have very much money. So, and I remember, so stuff like that, or, you know, I had a really crap ghetto blaster, and some of my friends had better ones and I didn't. And at that time, I was aware of the limitations of not having any dough. So that was when I kind of learned about that. So, you know, not that it's particularly relevant for this, but there was no lino. No spare lino, mate.
So you weren't a
B-boy. Lino.
You weren't a B-boy because you couldn't afford the lino.
No, well, I did my best. I mean, I wasn't a B-boy because I wasn't really up to it like, physically. But I did have a go, but I think...
No, I love that little era of music. And I think there's a lot of people that those street sounds, electro compilations were really significant.
It was massively significant.
Yeah.
It was this new sound. It was this, you know, and the breakdancing was a... was a movement as well that went with it, wasn't it? Graffiti, breakdancing, electro music. It was just, wicked. It was like a really, you know, and these are in the days before the internet, and it's just been such a big thing. You know,
yes.
I've talked about this quite a lot of time, but this is before the internet. So you were, the amount of stuff you could get hold of musically was really limited. Mm. So I'd get something like, you know, that track or, you know, I had two of the eight Crucial Electro things and listen to them again and again and again and again. And you know, that is sometimes when we're looking at our music consumption has changed, people sort of say, oh, it's a shame they don't listen to music like you used to, because you used to be you'd have one album for a week or for 2 weeks or a month, you wouldn't have another album, so you would just listen to it again and again, whereas now you've got whatever you want when you want. So it's an interesting thing, but in those days, it was really limited. So I listened to those music over and over and over again.
And read the sleeve notes again and again.
Exactly,
and know everything about everything on that record.
So what records? Were you going to record stores Saturday afternoon?
No, this is... this is when I was still like 12, 13.
Okay. So then it started to move in.
Yeah, so when I left school, I left school at 16 and went to work in an office in Forest Gate, very low level, doing low level, like filing and stuff. I was rubbish at it. And I stayed there for 8 years and was promoted once.
Can't have been
once.
That rubbish.
I was terrible. Well, I was promoted once. I was promoted once in 8 years. It was okay. I was really rubbish at it. It's one of them sort of places where they just can't sack you.
Oh, okay.
You know, it doesn't matter how rubbish you are.
Okay.
But in that time, but I was working, so it gave me money to buy records. And so when I was 16, 17, the Acid House thing happened. Mm. And again, that's another cultural revolution, I suppose.
Sure.
I don't want to get carried away, but...
No,
you know,
do, please do.
It was...
quite literally, some of them.
But there was this thing happened, and I was just at that age where I could go out to these raves, and you know, people wearing the clothes associated with it, and there were some record shops that were selling this music, and again, because there was no internet, the only you'd sit around your friend's house chatting with them about it, and then when the shop was open, you'd go down there. Buy records, you know.
What was that pivotal shop?
I used to go to all different ones. I was listening to a track just now, which is the first release on Reinforced Records, and that was in Sutton in Surrey, because one of my friends lived on an estate called Shanklin Village, and I used to go down there quite a bit just to hang out with them. And there was a shop next to the station, so I used to do that. I guess Boogie Times.
Yeah, Romford.
Yeah, what was the one downstairs in Mash Passion?
Okay, yeah, Mash was on Oxford.
Mash on Oxford Street.
Yeah,
downstairs. There was Unity, Black Market.
Yeah. Broadway
Street,
But yeah, so I used to go to the record shops and spend all of my money on records. And so I didn't get turntables because I could never save up enough because I always wanted more records. And it was like, I think I've got quite an addictive nature and I was addicted to buying vinyl, and I wanted to have every tune, so I'd stay up. So I was working, 9 to 5, not very good, but that's what I was. I was there, and then in the evenings, I'd go around Trevor's house, my mate Trev, and he, and or my mate Scotty's house, and we'd listen to music, and then we would often listen to Pirates if they were on during the week. They weren't often on.
Mm.
But if they were on, we'd listen to Pirates. And if they said the name of the track, I'd write it down. You know, there wasn't, what's this thing called?
Phone?
Forgetting it now. Shazam.
There were phones.
But there wasn't Shazam.
For some of our younger listeners should be aware.
There weren't mobile phones. There was no Shazam.
No.
There was no way of... Oh, you had to go into a record shop and say, what's the one that goes...
Yeah, that's it.
Yes, you did.
And they either said... there'd be somebody who's clued up and be like, that is Shades of Rhythm Homicide. Or they'd just look at you and go, like, I don't know what you're talking about, mate. And I worked in a record shop after a while, so I kind of had the other side of that, of people coming in and humming it. So I'd listen to these... I'd listen to the radio religiously and... try and work out what tunes were, and there would be certain tunes that were played a lot. This is like Sunrise, Centreforce, those sort of days.
Yeah,
and so who were the influencers, the who were the broadcasters that were reaching you? Who were the names? Was it Colin Dale, or like, we mentioned Westwood.
Yeah, I mean, Westwood was when I was like 12, 13 and into hip hop, but by the time I was 16, 17, I was into the rave thing. And I guess it was the Centreforce DJs that would have been the real... And because I lived over that, I lived Forest Gate, and there a lot of them were the West Ham lot.
Yeah,
did Centre Force, and so it was those sort of people who I would be.
Maybe HMS.
Yeah. There's a few. I mean, there was people that on flyers like all these names. There's some of them that are still going, which is quite a feat, isn't it?
Quite a lot, actually.
Yeah.
Like
Groove and Fabs and those sort of people.
Slip Matt and whatever still.
Yeah, and but there were people like Aslam Mack that I did, these names that I remember, like,
yeah,
and I'll never forget, but I you don't see them anymore. But these are people that I used to hear about, and there was someone called Shadowfax and Unknown. All these names, and I was just, you know, the thing is, I was in my mate Trevor's house in Forest Gate. We didn't know anyone. We didn't have any connections to any DJs. We didn't know anyone or anything. We just had the pirate radio, and so, you know, in like as I've progressed in life and seen how some of the DJs that I've met, their dads were famous musicians, and it gave them a real foot up. And other people had this or they had that. Me and Trev was in Forest Gate. We didn't have anything.
We didn't even have a lino.
We didn't even. If there's any lino, it's going on the kitchen floor, mate. It's not going in the garden to dance on.
Yeah.
You know. So me and Trev, we just had each other. Oh. Me and Trev. So
Did you start DJing at this point?
Not really, because I didn't.
You couldn't afford the.
I didn't
decks,
have turntables.
Yeah. He was buying so much vinyl.
Yeah. So I never. All I was doing was doing the pause button buy these vinyls and play 8 bars of one and then press pause and then change the vinyl and then do the pause at the right time to play 8 bars of the next thing. So I'd make a track that was 5 minutes long that had 8 bars of all different tracks going from one to the other into the other into the other. And
so you were editing, just really crudely editing?
Yeah, basically.
Edits.
Yeah, exactly. On my mum's stereo.
Yeah.
And then so I was buying records, and if you'll indulge me by letting me play one of these, a track, you know, of that sort of era.
Please
of the really early ones, I think that one of my favourite, there's a lot of stuff was coming over from Detroit, and there was, I think it's an interesting time because there's all this music coming over from Detroit, but then there's the stuff started getting made in England. At first, it was more Detroit. It was machines. It was, you know, like 4/4. It wasn't so much breakbeat. So I'll play one of these ones that was a good version of that. If here we are.
And just to put a pin in the year, in the diary, so this would be 88, 89, that kind of...
Exactly. This is 88. This is... Rhythm is rhythm. It is what it is.
Trailblazers. DJ Zinc.
Okay, so that's Rhythm is What It Is. That is definitely one of my favourite tracks of all time. And that's a great example for me. It kind of what I realised when I started making house maybe 7 years ago was nearly everything I do is basically a version of that. You know, like there's like a sort of lead noise sometimes. There's a bass line.
Does Derek May know this?
But well, you know, I did actually, I think I mentioned it. I think I said basically this is the blueprint for pretty much everything I've done.
All right, okay.
So, but I didn't want to be too explicit in case he asked for 20%.
No, you know? Okay.
but yeah, I mean, you know, listening to it, that's for me, it's just the perfect track. And what I love about it as well is that it's the sort of strings are they're not perfectly in tune because it's from an old synth. Everything's slightly out, and not in a bad way, but in a way that is of, you know, it's a great example of that era.
Makes it real.
It just has this sort of depth and this sort of vibe to it.
None of the early Gary Newman tunes were in tune.
You know what I was just going to say? Was something that Gary said when we had him here as a guest. The same thing. It wasn't quite in tune. It wasn't quite.
We didn't have a tuner. Yeah, we just tuned it by ear.
That's it as well. And because all of the machines were not tuned to a quartz or anything. You tune it by ear, so everything tuned. So it's like a band. You know, when you get a band playing music together and the guitar and the bass, and they tune to each other.
Yeah.
There is an element of imperfection that gives it this sort of depth and this life. Same as an orchestra, you know. That's why 12 violins sound different to one, you know, because everyone's slightly different already, and it gives it that sort of... And so this is... to me, it's got a life in it that is just...
It does make it organic, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And when you make records these days, do you sometimes leave in elements of imperfection where you're like, you know, I know that is not quite right, but it's working, so let's just go with it?
I probably do without
realising.
Exactly. It's not really... Okay. I'd love to think that I was on top of my production to the point where I was making mistakes on purpose, but I think that... No, I still used old synths. And I use hardware.
Yeah, yeah.
And even if I use a plugin to get a bass or a synth or something, it goes through hardware, and so it then gets artifacts and imperfections through going through the hardware.
Mm.
And I think that it gives it. It gives it something.
Well,
you know,
yeah. that's what I was going to say. It makes it sound like a human is involved.
Yeah,
sometimes.
It's something. It's hard to explain what it's hard to know exactly what it does. I've tried. You know, I'm a sort of person that likes to figure everything out. So, you know, there's harmonic distortion. There's all this sort of stuff. It's hard to kind of to definitely know what it does, but it does something. And you know, when I think of digital, you could make it all in your laptop. In theory, to me, it will sound better and it's cleaner and it's all that, but I just prefer it when it goes through the hardware.
Well, it's just all binary, isn't it? Humanity.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky though, because you know, people say keep it analog, but then it is digital. Some of the analog stuff is digital, and so it's not always. So, you know, some of the digital stuff had these converters that were really good, that gave it a certain sound, that weren't very good, but they just gave it a sound. You know, it's like vinyl is...
Well, that was my next question. I was going to say, where do you stand on that?
One of the things I love about vinyl is the sound of vinyl. For example, I got a track by TC and a track by High Contrast, where they had sent me the unmastered MP3, or, you know, the MP3. Mm. And then I got the vinyl of it, and then I compared how it would sound if I'd have played a CD or Serato versus how it would play
yeah.
you know, how the vinyl would sound, mastered vinyl.
Mm.
And then I got everything I played, I put it through an EQ curve and compression, so it sounded like it was on vinyl, even though I was using Serato.
Yep.
And so I think that there is some great stuff about vinyl, but you can actually replicate that. It's just because the limitations, you know, the bass had to be mono, the treble couldn't go too much because the head would get too hot. Well, that's what the needle would get too hot, so they had to really compress the tops, and it gave it this lovely silky sound, you know. And so I was aware of that. I remember at the time that I was, you know, I used to take my vinyl when I was DJing abroad on the rider. It would say Zinc will be using Serato, and then I would take vinyl in case there was a problem.
Yes.
And when I remember this, you know, this must be 10 years ago at least. And I remember going, you know, turning up at the airport, and people would say, great, you did bring your dub plate. Fuck Serato. And I'd say, you lot are stupid, man. Like, what is the matter with you? Who cares? Mm. Are you interested in the music I'm going to play? Or are you interested in, I happen to be getting a vinyl, or I'm doing, you know, who cares? But anyway, these people did care. And so I would always say, come to the sound check. We'll see, you know, see if you can tell me which one sounds better than the other.
Yeah.
And it was just, they just couldn't tell.
Yeah.
I'd say, you know, I'd get the same track. I'd play a dub plate, get the Serato, switch, you know, A to B. And I'd say, right, which one's which? And they'd be like, I don't know. And so for me, it was this culture, but cultures change, you know, things move on. And I've never been stuck with with books. I've got a Kindle. I couldn't care less about books. I care about the words.
Yeah.
You know, and I say to my family when, you know, I have dinner with my family every Sunday, and I've said that before about books. I'm like, who cares about books? And they're like, you know, want to beat me up, you know, between and like kick the shit out of me. But I think, but that's, you know, so I don't care about leaving formats behind. It's, to me, there's a sort of central thing that's really important.
So let's now, if you, going back to the chronological timeline, have you actually got a pair of decks?
Rewind.
Yet?
Have you got a rewind noise?
you still hadn't got. You were such
still
a vinyl
didn't have any
junkie.
Turntables. Can you
when,
believe
when
it?
Do the decks come into the picture?
Okay,
pictures?
Well, Trevor, who was DJ Swift, but not Mampy Swift, because there was always this confusion over.
Okay,
there was two Swifts, but my mate Trev in Forest Gate.
One of them swifter than the other, presumably the one who was Swift first.
The first Swift was swifter, exactly. Trev, me and my mate Trev, saved up and got decks, but it was like a box that had two turntables in it, and to turn the volume up on the right turntable, there was a twisty knob, and the left, and there was no crossfader, there were just 33, 45, and then volume for each one. So you could only mix records at the same speed, or very close, and then twist it with your hand. And so that's what me and Trev used to mix on. And this was that. So this is around about 89 and 90.
Yeah.
And then the first time I ever touched a pair of Technics, I mean, it's, sounds like at the time it was such a big deal, but now I talk, it sounds like a bit of like a weird like Alan Partridge. First time I touched Technics was the first pirate radio show I did with Trev, and it used to be me and Trevor.
Which station is this?
This was called Impact FM, okay. Which then became Format FM.
Okay.
And
this is still in Forest Gate?
This was in Clapton yeah. Park in right. Hackney. Yeah, the first, and the tower blocks now have been knocked down, but we did that at Hackney Wick, Hackney. It was all around that way, the tower blocks were. And so me and Trev went and did our first show, and well, I didn't even know. Somebody had sent one of our mixtapes to the station, and so Trev, I had a Saturday job as well, and so I just got back from my Saturday job at 1 p.m., 2 p.m., and Trev said, oh, we've got a radio show today. You've got to come now. So I remember, you know, and I had to wear a pair of his trainers because I was wearing shoes and I didn't want to go there in a pair of shoes and look like
no.
a square. You know? So I wore Trevor's trainers and he's got much smaller feet than me. So it was, it was just a standard.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I'm just blown away that you managed to do a mixtape on turntables that couldn't pitch.
I know. I tell you what, from there, it's everything there was just easy peasy.
Yeah.
Go to a pair of Technics and it was like, they're doing all the work for you, really. You know, we had been, I think maybe he had one sound lab by then. So there was one with pitch and then the other not. And the MRT60 mixer, do you remember those? The blue and yellow mixers and they each had like a five band.
Yes, I do, actually.
This is a... should be on one of those like back to the 80s websites, but anyway. So we went and did our first show on Pirate, and that was the first time I touched Technics, and so it was a big moment for us, and it was just really, you know, it's just me and Trev from Forest Gate. We don't know anyone, we don't really we've never played at any raves, or you know, maybe a couple of we've played at a few house parties, but we don't really, you know, so it was really
It was big.
It was a big deal for us.
And what were you playing?
We were playing, it was 91, so we were playing, this is kind of the era when it was going from the, you know, like the track we just played, Is What It Is.
Yes.
Into more UK stuff.
Okay. So the emergence of some breakbeat.
And one thing that I loved about it, one thing that I really liked was that with the Detroit stuff, I loved it and it was great, but I didn't feel particularly connected to it.
Mm.
You know, we were talking about Guru Josh, who died recently, and his that sort of stuff, the sort of pop dance stuff, and Pacific State, I didn't feel very connected to, because it was just it's like a pop. There was no sort of bridge between me and this thing. I'm a big fan of it. I love it. Mm. I'm obsessed with it, but I don't feel any connection. And then there was stuff like Shut Up and Dance came along. And this is Two Blokes from Hackney. It's Two Blokes from Hackney. And this is, hold on a sec. This is just like People I Know. This is, all of a sudden it went from being this distant, disconnected thing to being a thing of like, wow, okay, this is, you know, even the pirate radio stations, I was a bit like, I'd phone up the number and ask what song they were playing and that sort of stuff. But I didn't really feel that connected to it. And then all of a sudden I started to feel, through one way or another, more connected with this stuff. So, I could play you.
Hello.
Exactly. I could play you. There's so many tracks that I could, I'm just going to choose one from about seven or eight I could play just from Aeson. There's about a million tracks I could play from this era that are perfect examples, but this is the perfect example. This is Aeson, Trip to the Moon, Part One.
Trailblazers, DJ Zinc.
James Bond bit is just superb. Absolutely superb.
Vibes. So that is a great example of, the stuff I was listening to, the stuff I was playing on radio, it had gone from Detroit, and then that was, this was more like a sort of ravey, quite happy bits and pieces in it. And then there started to be something that was a bit darker, a bit more, I guess, early jungle. I mean, jungle was kind of starting already now with Shut Up and Dance and stuff like that. But this track now is something by a guy called Gerald. And this is a great, this is a, another example. If you were listening to Defected, Weekend Rush, Round and Round 1992, you would have heard this track every single show for about 6 months. Everybody played it again and again and again and again. It's just such a good tune. And it's a good example. You know, this, the next one I want to play, and we'll just play a bit of it because I don't want to take up all the time playing, you know, this nostalgia thing.
But oh, go
it's,
on.
It's a, you know, this is, it's a little bit faster. It's a bit darker. It's a bit more like, you know, we're getting into something else now.
Okay.
And so this is a guy called Gerald. Anything can happen.
Trailblazers, DJ Zinc.
So that was a guy called Gerald, Anything Can Happen, and it was just a, you know, perfect pirate radio song.
Yeah, and like you say,
bit dark.
Something darker was happening. So we were in, we were still in those glory days of, you mentioned Smiley and PJ, Shut Up and Dance, you know, Total Heroes, people like that taking huge samples, and it was very, the music was quite happy, you know, with these massive sort of Annie Lennox sample here or a, you know, whatever it was, I'm raving, or, you know, those like huge, huge samples of tracks. But then something twisted and it just got a bit darker. And I'm guessing that your radio show that you did in Hackney was reflecting this.
Yeah, and I tell you one thing I remember is I started playing, when once we were on Pirate Radio, me and Trev started to play at raves a little bit, Swift and Zinc, me and Trev, and I remember playing at a few raves where they would have hardcore DJs and jungle DJs in the same room, sort of in order to get the, because then people were still raving together. But me and Trev were really, not snobby, but we were like, well, maybe we were like, this is fucking rubbish, happy hardcore stuff, man, fuck off. You know, we used to take the piss out of the DJs and be not like bullies, but just to be a bit like, fucking, what is this shit?
Yeah.
And it was a bit like that, you know. So I remember there being this, it was, there was a clear thing where there was the sort of happier pianos, the sort of plinky plonky thing, and there was this jungle thing, which was like darker, a different sort of thing. And I was interested in that, you know, and, but you can tell from that track, Anything Can Happen, and the breakbeats in it, you know, there was two breakbeats in that track that I love, and the Detroit stuff didn't have so much breakbeats. So I think that that was one thing that I really noticed about how the music started getting faster and breakbeats started to be more more prevalent. I think that that appealed to the hip hop thing that I'd, it sort of went back to that for me. So
because of course a lot of it was based on the Amen Break, and that was, you know,
that was a bit later, I think, but at this time there wasn't so much Amen stuff. It was more all different breakbeats, you know. I'm not meant to eat a biscuit, am I, while I'm talking?
And everybody who was making records at that time, you know, had grown up on those hip hop records, and that was why Ben said he felt more connected to it. Yes, because it reflected, you know, these are just speeded up breaks from records that we all knew from just a few years before.
So
exactly.
So Ben, you're on the radio in this in pirate thing, and you've got the knowledge, and you've got the skills, and you're DJing. So what was the junction at point at which you thought, you know what, I can do this, I'm going to make a tune?
Well, it was kind of the done thing, I guess. It was like the sort of obvious path. I remember being on Pirate Radio, and there's a bloke, I think it was called Mike Ash, and he did this mashed EP on Moving Shadow. And, you know, he was just a bloke who was in there, but me and Trevor were like, wow, there's, you know, like Nick did the bouncer shit. If I'd have met Nick when he did the Bouncer tune, I would have been in, you know, I mean, I'm in awe of him now, and I'm very, you know, you know, I got a lot of time for him. But back then I would have been like, you know, like fucking with Jesus or something, you know, this is because in, you know, nowadays you need a laptop and you know, time to look at tutorials. You can make tunes. But in those days, you even had to know somebody. You even had to have your own studio, which was outrageous. I couldn't afford Lionel. Come on, mate. Yeah. You know, and so you either had to have your own studio or you had to have an access to a studio. And I didn't have either. So there was no bridge between me and this other thing. And then I started doing pirate radio, and all of a sudden I would see some, you know, here's Mike Ash, he's got this thing on, and there's the geezer, and it's... And he can't actually walk on water. He's a normal bloke. Mm. And he's managed to work it out somehow. And so it became more like, this is something that I can do. Mm. And so Busy Bee was a DJ on the same station. And he had a studio. He had a really basic studio. And he said to me, if you drive me to Tasco's warehouse, because I had a car, I had a Mini Metro. Yeah, smashing it back then in my green Mini Metro. And so he said,
"Got a pair
to
of trainers that fitted you by that point." I did. Well, still wearing,
you know what? I did.
A pair of shoes that were.
I didn't
two
wear Trevor's trainers. No, I didn't wear Trevor's trainers
to drive
always
to,
for no, radio. Okay, right. It was just the first show.
Oh, okay, fine. Glad we cleared that up. Yeah,
yeah. Imagine if they'd been like my lucky trainers now. I've got to wear them.
My feet are in agony.
It'd have been like a sort of 15th century Chinese woman
exactly,
or something,
with them,
you know.
Tiddly feet.
Bound up.
Anyway, so Busy said to me, if you drive me to Tesco's warehouse to give out some promos, I'll let you use the studio for £4 an hour. Sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But that is exactly what he said. And I was like, off we go. You know, let's go Tesco's. And really, I would have driven him there for nothing, because we went into Tesco's warehouse without paying. This was a rave warehouse venue in Plumstead that was, you know, somewhere that I would have gone and paid to get in. Yeah. And all of a sudden, we're turning up there. He's walking to the front of the queue. He's like, yeah, yeah, I'm Busy B. I've got to give some promos to the people. These guys are with me. And they're like, yeah, cool, go in. We were like, wow, this is amazing.
This is the same story as the Prodigy story, where like the guys would have been paying to go to those raves anyway,
yeah,
and being in a band that were getting booked, well, great, well, that means that we don't have to pay to go to the raves.
Yeah,
how brilliant is that?
Yeah,
yeah. That's pretty much my whole job. It's like now I make music. I would do it for nothing. I love it. It's like a hobby. And then someone says, and there's some money. It's like, oh, okay, I'm not going to argue, but
you get paid for this,
really. Anyway, So Busy said that, and so I drove him to Tesco's warehouse. We went in Tesco's. It was really cool and exciting, and we got to go in the studio. So we booked it like 4 weeks in advance. So I had 4 weeks to get my samples together, work out what breakbeats I'm going to use, get an idea of what I'm going to make this tune. And nowadays I'm aware that I don't have that 4 to 6 weeks thinking period before I make a tune, because I've got a studio. You're basically on my phone. I can make a tune. I can make it on my phone, my laptop. I've got a studio in my house. Wherever I am, whatever I'm doing, I can, you know, do a rough track. But yeah, so I had like 4 to 6 weeks to sit there, think about, I'm going to do something like this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And I think it's really valuable to have that time away from a studio. So me and Trevor went to Busy's house, and we made Swift and Zinc Volume 1. And so we did that, and we put that out, and it did all right. You know, we sold, well, you know, I at the time we were like, oh, it's done all right. It sold 1,200 or something. You know, it done all right. It wasn't very good, but it was all right. And then, you know, Swift and Zinc Volume 2, we sold. It was all right. We did about 3,500 final.
When you say you put it out, that's easier said than done in those days, isn't it?
It was, yeah. I mean, it was, there were hurdles, and the biggest one was not having a clue what we were doing. So, but, you know, Busy was helpful, and he had a label called Brain Records, and I didn't want to, I don't know how I had this in my head at this point, but I wanted to do it on a label that I sort of was in charge of, and not let him do the sort of put it into his schedule and all that sort of stuff. So I said to him, can we do it as Brain Progression? So it's like a sort of, he owns it, but we will, you know, he basically owns it, and it's using his setup and his distribution.
Imprint, yeah.
But it's going to be, but it will be our little offshoot. So he was like, yeah, cool. And so we did that. And so, and then I'm going to play you a track now, which is, this is Swift and Zinc Volume 3. And I think that this is one that we did. I can look at the label, actually, because someone scanned the label. Engineered by Busy Bee and Swift and Zinc at Brain Studio. So, yeah, this is a Busy Studio in Leytonstone in his cellar with his crazy dogs. And so I'll play this. This is called See Your Sweat by Swift and Zinc. This is a.k.a. Ben and Trev. Here we go.
What a history.
Yes.
Trailblazers. DJ Zinc.
Want to hear more of the music?
Don't forget, you can listen to the tracks in full by heading over to Deezer.com.
Where you'll also find special Trailblazers playlists.
Deezer. Originals. Trailblazers.
What a lovely beeline. What a great bit of history.
That beeline is just the tone, the sub that comes straight out of an S950. It just had this, a sine wave in it. And, felt a bit sort of basic at the time, but actually it works, who cares?
Yeah, that's such a rich sound. Love it.
That was See You Sweat by Swift and Zinc on Brain Production Records.
Your third outing on
Vine.
Yeah.
So we did that for a while, me and Trev, and we got up to Swift and Zinc Volume 7, I think, and then we had a track release on Sub Bass. Suburban Bass Records.
Run out of Boogie Times,
exactly,
in Romford.
Exactly, yeah. So we had a single out on Suburban Bass, and then okay. So in these days, So I remember actually one of the Swift and Zincs. I remember, and now I used to go to at this time. I was working in Forest Gate still, and
you're still at that job that you hated.
Yeah.
But you had an income to buy all this, all the vinyl stuff.
And so there was a record shop in Forest Gate. Actually, I mean, I worked in that place for 8 years, and for the first maybe 6 years, there was a record shop in Forest Gate that sold pop music, but also had some dance stuff. And I used to go in there every day at lunchtime, every day. And it is like there was a comedy film or something, wasn't there, like a few years ago? And I imagine it was just like that, because it was these blokes, having a cup of tea, and we'd take turns to make the tea and all that sort of stuff. They were nice blokes, and they sort of. They used to, I remember, they'd try and get these records for me, but they were not in the rave scene at all. So I was interested in this stuff, and these blokes were just, they're interested in pop and that. So I used to go there every day. And then The Underground opened, and The Underground had DJ Randall worked in there, who was like this legendary local. He's from Forest Gate as well. So he's this legendary local bloke who's doing, I remember talking, discussing with somebody, Danny Brakes, about, he was saying, oh, Randall's playing in, so and so tonight, and then he's playing so and so tomorrow, and then he sort of said about roughly the sort of fee he would be getting, and I was like, wow, that's what I get in a week. I was like, this is unbelievable. And so Randall used to work in The Underground, and another thing that he used to do, he would be playing the records. When you work in a record shop, you play the records. He would mix from one to the other, but he wouldn't touch the platter. He would just do it with the pitch. And we would be looking there like, no way. He just mixed that without fucking touching it. Can you believe it?
That's Jedi.
He was like, we were like, wow. And
I had a wow moment once on the mix front. Not in that era, a bit later. This guy, Michael Kilkey, used to play at the Tunnel in Glasgow. And he what impressed me about him, a couple of techniques. But, generally, he'd, get it in, and then he'd just be flicking through his record box, not even looking at the deck, and just a bit of that, slow it down.
Yeah.
Not looking at, just...
There were some lads on Pirate, and they used to, when I was doing the Pirates, they're sort of... this thing they used to try and do was, one of them would get it in the mix, and then he'd go to the loo, come back, and it'd still be in the mix. We were like, this is a reefer and somebody else, these two blokes, like 91.
Right.
This was so impressive. And so Randall worked in this shop, and I used to go in there in my lunch hour and buy records. And I remember the Underground was quite a big record shop for, you know, Cool and Flex work there. All these people that were sort of big rave underground producers, Uncle 22, and Hype used to go there sometimes. And he went there. I remember, I think he was there, or I saw him in Boogie Times, and I gave him a copy of Swift and Zinc Volume 6 or Volume 7. And then I saw him a few weeks later, and he said, "Oh, yeah, that tune you gave me, I played it in Germany. Bassline's shit." So I said, okay. And I was surprised that he's pretty direct. And so.
Not very constructive.
Yeah, he was like, "Bassline was shit." So I said, "Well, how could it be better?" So he was like, "Well, if you'd have done this and this and this." And I was like, "I'm fucking all ears, mate. I'm all ears." And so, you know, I then went away and did some of what he said and waited till next time I saw, you know, or got his number, and then tried to do what some of what he'd said, and then gave him the results. And I think that was the results were the thing that went on Sub Bass. And he was like, "Yeah, this is a bit like it," and da-da-da. But he really helped me. I was really influenced by him in terms of the sound, because at that time I was kind of more into the Bookham-y musical stuff like that, and then
intelligent stuff.
Yeah, the don't let any in the jungle, lads. See, you say that though, the intelligent stuff. But yeah, I was into a mixture of all of it, and I used to go around Bookham's house. I was friends with Bookham, and used to hang out with Pesce and that sort of stuff. And I was into that stuff. But when I, like, the way Hype was really hands-on about how I could improve what I was doing, I was like, "Great, you know, tell me more." And so I did a few things. And then after a while, I did Super Sharp Shooter. And I did that, the original. I remember Danny Brakes had just done a track, and he'd sampled Method Man, I think, or Red Man. And so he had done that, and then my friend Colin Francis, who's now the sort of big Ministry of Sound DJ and all this stuff. So in 1992, I was engineering a track for him in Trevor's house now, because me and Trevor, with Swift and Zinc Volume 2, we bought our own studio stuff, and then we started doing... So I remember engineering for Colin Francis, you know, working on a track for him, and he was using hip-hop in that as well. And it kind of, you know, I just got the samples together and did the original of Super Sharp Shooter, And I remember playing it to Hype and saying, "Oh, what do you think of this?" And he was like, "Yeah, it's cool." And then a couple of weeks later, he said, "Oh, I'd like to put it out on Ganja." And I was like, over the moon, because, you know, I thought, this is great. This is a really, you know, really, really good thing. And so that was how I started working with Hype. And he was already working with Pascal. And so for a while, I put out some tracks on Hype's label, Ganja Records, and on Pascal's label, Frontline. And Super Sharp Shooter, the remix of Super Sharp Shooter was the one that is the better known one. Mm-hmm. So we can...
Let's hear it.
And when you say remix, was it you that remixed? Was it you guys?
Yeah. It was my mix of my track. So I did the original, and then I did the original, and then I did a remix of it. You know, like I did a...
A fresh take.
Yeah, I thought, yeah. I want to.
That became the definitive version.
And I think at the time, I don't know if people do it so much now, but at the time there were lots of, I don't know, if a track did quite well, you'd do a remix.
You'd do a VIP
or you'd do a remix. It was pretty much, you know, I don't know if it's to sort of milk it a bit more, or if it's because there was a lack of, I don't know why, but for whatever reason, that's the sort of culture that I was in. So let's play.
And it's, I was just going to say, not that unusual that somebody makes a track and then does a second version.
Of course.
And the version that follows becomes the definitive version.
Yeah,
so just another Prodigy one. That's the case with Charlie, actually. The Alley Cat mix is the, you know, the sort of definitive version with like the Mentasmic, but then that was the second version.
Yeah, exactly.
Same thing.
So cool, right, so let's listen to that.
Let's hear it.
Trailblazers, DJ Zinc.
The S, the U, the P, the E, the the S, the H, the A, the R, the P, the S, the H, the O, the O, the T, the E, the R.
So that was Super Sharp Shooter.
Never going to get bored of that.
The track that changed my life.
Oh, I mean, my God.
I don't want to sound gushy or anything.
Well, let us gush then. That's one of the best. That is one of the best tunes ever made, ever. That is just, oh, my God. It's just, oh.
No, brilliant.
I can't even find words.
It was
let me ask you
nice
something.
How it came together.
So, yeah, but how did it come together? So obviously you've got Method Man. And then, so who
I phoned him up. I was like, Meth, do us a favour. No, I mean, this is all samples, you know.
Yeah, and so, and was the with the Your alphabet Honor. Bits, was that LL Cool J?
LL Cool J, yes.
And
Your Honour.
that was Trev.
And so, yeah, that was Trev. He's all Trev pretending. There is a version of Super Shark Shooter where we got Pascal's friend to redo the Method Man bits because it was for a sub bass compilation because we didn't want to, you know, because we thought that is going to be hot. It's going to be a problem. Not hot as in good, hot as in we're going to get in trouble.
Yeah. And how did Super Sharp Shooter come to get, like, how did the whole concept of it, like, where did it come from?
It is from a UK hip hop a cappella. I think it's called Reverse the Hearse. And the bloke said, you know, in the thing it says it's a Super Sharp Shooter shooting shots.
Oh, yeah.
I just took it and, you know, and
cut it up,
played it, yeah, and yeah. It just, you know, the thing is that you know, that track really did change my life, and basically because of what I was doing in that you know, that track and the Ready or Not, the Fugees thing, I left the 8 year, you know, my 8 years was up. It was a sad day, you know. I did a very sad when I handed in my notice. Like, not at all. I was fucking over the moon. I was like, yes, I don't have to do this anymore.
Did it explode straight away?
Well, the thing is, I'm quite a granddaddy sort of dude. So I waited until I was definitely able, you know, I was really definitely cool money wise because I thought, because if that went wrong, I didn't have anything else to fall back on. So I waited. But, you know, there was a situation, there was a period of time where on a Friday night, I'd be going to Germany to DJ, and, you know, I'd come in on a Monday morning and they'd be like, hello, Ben, did you have a nice weekend? And I'd be like, yeah, you know, and everybody was, it was just like a little office and everyone had been watching the TV and that. And I'd say, oh, yeah, I went to Germany. They'd be like, come on, Ben, where, you know, it was like weird because I was in this really boring, crappy office but was then doing these quite cool things. So I did Super Sharp Shooter and that remix, and it was popular. And I didn't know at the time. I didn't make it and think, yeah, this is going to be big. Or I didn't. I just thought it works and I like it. So it did well.
And Hype liked it. And Pascal
Hype liked
it.
And then around the same time, I did the Fugees Ready or Not remix.
Yeah.
And that was. And you know, there was confusion. A lot of people thought that Hype did it, but I did it. But he helped with the bass line. Had a different bass line originally, and then I played it to him, and he was like, "It's good, but it'd be better if the bass line was more like Hello Lover, which was one of his tunes." He said, "It'd be better if it was like that sort of thing." And so I took it away, redid it, took it back, and he was like, "Yeah, this is cool."
So he was effectively A&R-ing you at that time.
Yeah, executive producer. I mean, if you look on the records at the time, we used to write executive producer, did you? Because he was influential in the stuff.
Yes,
you know,
I
wasn't just
remember seeing
just,
that.
Yeah, and so that's what it was. You know, I wanted that to be on there because I thought it's fair. You know, he's having a lot of influence, so fair play if he gets recognition for it.
Yeah.
So so I did the Ready or Not remix around the same time, and because of those two tracks, you know, I started to get my name out for DJing, and so I was able to leave my office job.
You say remix, was the Ready or Not one an official remix or just a bootleg?
It was a bootleg.
Yeah, I thought it was.
Your Honour. I won't keep saying that same joke. But it was, yeah, my friend gave me, I got it off my friend from Germany who had copied a cassette to cassette of it. So I sampled that. So the Ready or Not remix is just sampled from a cassette.
Wow.
Yeah. So I don't even know if it was out in England when I got it from him. He was like a really cool dude in Germany who used to get all this music. And so I got a copy of the Fugees album off of him. So yeah, so I did that remix, and that was popular. And around that time, you know, it just happened that the sort of stuff that I was making at that time was what was popular, and so.
So
you know,
the sort
little,
of the vinyl,
at a moment.
The vinyl sales of stuff like this. Then we're in the tens of thousands.
So with the Super Sharpshooter, I think we did like 12,000, and then it got signed to BMG, and they did however many they did. So something like that, 12,000, 14,000, and the so and that was more. That was like fucking you know. Compared to nowadays, you know, we were like, oh, it's okay, it's done 12,000, and it's like fucking great compared to nowadays, isn't it?
Well, I was at Radio 1 then, and I remember the BMG, and I was aware of you because I was going to metalheads, and you know, Jungle was my like entry point into dance music, and I remember bringing this record, and I'd heard it in clubs, and I remember thinking, wow, you know, it's really like Inner City Life's happen, you know, I can't remember, was that that had happened, and suddenly, like Zinc, Pascal Hype, they're on BMG, man. This is huge. Like this is absolutely massive.
Yeah, it was an interesting time.
You're right. It was a moment, and that was my Adam F. when I signed Adam then to essentially to Positiva / EMI. That would have been around that zone.
All the majors came in and wanted to sign. You know, whoever was able to deliver half decent album, I guess.
Yeah,
is what it adds up.
Ronnie Size on Talking Loud.
Yeah, I mean, he delivered an album, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Mercury. Yeah, absolutely. So then you became the Ganja Crew. You know, you just kind of solidified together.
Yeah, I never really smoked weed. Hype used to smoke weed.
Yeah,
and he had Ganja Records, so we called it Ganja Crew. But I was never really into smoking weed. Sorry about that. Trade description.
Another stereotype shattered.
Red card.
Me neither.
Red card.
fair play, mate.
Weed smokers crying, you know, bastard. I thought he was one of us.
Oh, man. You've broken some hearts there, definitely.
Stoner's hearts.
Corrupt FM.
So I did the Ready or Not, and then we started True Players. And so... And that was did we do that after the, I think it was about the same time as BMG thing. We started the label True Players. And again, vinyl, we were doing 12,000-15,000 of each one. And that was not bad for a label at the time, you know. And it was, you know, in hindsight, it was great.
To be fair, the moment, it was more than a moment, because actually thinking about it, the Adam F. thing was later. And some of this stuff was, this was sort of what, it kind of happened between like 95 through to 97.
Yeah, 97, 98,
it's a couple of years of moment.
Yeah, the Ganja Crew, the BMG stuff, I was never really that engaged with that, I think it's fair to say. But the Players label, I was very engaged in that. I'm more interested in underground independent music, I'm trying to think what the BMG releases were. I can remember there's one called Fuck the Millennium EP and other stuff, but yeah, so the Players label started I think in 96, and me, Hype and Pascal, we used to release our music on that, so that was when it was getting a bit more, when Jungle was kind of getting more into drum and bass. So I was never really, I did some tracks with some ragga samples in, but I was never really that into ragga enough to be able to do it with authority or, you know, to know what I was doing, where Hype did more stuff like that, that was more of his sort of background. So then the music started getting more into sort of drum and bass kind of stuff around 97, 98.
Where you started getting feeling disenfranchised by it or with it or something? You started feeling
disenfranchised by
drum and bass. Did you start feeling because there was a point in your life when you...
I'm just googling what disenfranchised means.
Did you feel like that you were becoming more distant from what other people were doing in drum and bass, and therefore you felt weren't so such a part of it? Because what I'm trying to get at is,
come on, Eddie,
is what made you sort of leave that genre or that okay. sort of what that made you kind of like
that didn't happen for a little while yet. We're going to get there.
Okay.
But in a few years you did start to morph your sound, didn't you? And
The music was getting more like, I guess, more like drum and bass now. This is Ed Rush and Optical appeared on the scene. There's been, I think, like with that, with Jungle and drum and bass, there's some producers come along now and again who kind of give everybody a kick up the arse or mm-hmm. sort of shape the sound a little bit. And Ed Rush and Optical were a good example of, you know, Ed Optical was and is a very good engineer. And compared to us lot, he was sad, you know, he was like sort of doing stuff that we hadn't really thought about doing.
Right.
And there was, I think there was competition without it being really obvious with stuff like what we were doing in Full Cycle. I remember DJ Dyer saying to me, he made Clear Skies after he heard Reach Out, and which I never knew at the time. And I used to love Clear Skies. So it was so nice that he said that. Mm. And there was loads of tracks that I listened to their tracks and then went and made something influenced by it. So this was like 97, 98, and I did tracks like Reach Out on Players and stuff like that. And then in 1999, I think it was, I wanted to do an album. I remember Hype saying, no, just do an EP, don't do an album. And I can't remember why it was, but so I did an 8-track EP. And I did, the tunes on it were all right, and they did pretty well. But at the end, the 8th track was 138 Trick. Mm. And so what I did was, like, I was doing drum and bass at the time, and I think we had done a track on a BMG EP where my brother had played drums, and we had done it at 138 BPM, I think. Mm. So I'd already kind of been aware.
Dabbled
a little bit. Mm. But I thought, I'm just going to put a track on the end of this EP that is going to basically show versatility. It's just something like a little mess about. Do something else.
Yep.
And so I did that, and when I did it, I sent it off to a few breakbeat DJs. I thought this is the breakbeat DJs will play this, but I didn't think the UK Garage would. Mm. So I sent it to a few of them, and some people like Klaus, who I don't know if you know Klaus. He
Heavyweight Hill.
So he played it. He said, "Hey, I really like it," and I didn't really think anything more of it. I just thought, okay, cool. And then people like Slimzy started playing it, and Genius and Slimzy. And they, some of the UK Garage DJs were fitting it in with the UK Garage sets, and it started to get popular within that scene, and breakbeat it started to pick up as well.
Mm.
And so it started to have a life of its own, this track.
Did it end up being bigger than any of the other tracks?
Yeah, it did.
So
yeah,
it's the classic story of like, hey, well, just that this is like the last one.
This little weird one on the
end. Weird one on the end ends up becoming.
Absolutely, yeah. So it was. And so ever since then, I've been putting weird ones in. And it hasn't happened again, but I'll keep trying. Don't worry, I will keep trying.
I vaguely remember, didn't Aston and Matt Freestylers support you massively back in those days? And Freak Nasty, people like that.
Yeah, I think that. Particularly once I started doing those first Bingo releases, all of those guys, you know, it fitted with what they were doing. So I was lucky that it kind of fit within two scenes, the breakbeat scene and the garage scene.
Yeah.
So
we should listen to it.
You ready?
Trailblazers, DJ Zinc.
So you started to redefine yourself musically.
I mean, it wasn't a conscious thing. I was just putting a track on the end of an EP as a mess about, really. But it did really well. It picked up. A lot of people were playing it. It got signed by Azuli.
Mm-hmm.
And
you started
GQ
to...
GQ put a vocal on it. It went top 40.
Oh, yes, of course.
So that was another one that changed my life. And... after that, I did a few more tracks in the same vein, like one called Hold On, Go DJ.
That was great. Go DJ was fantastic.
Kind of Funky, Hello. So these are the Hello.
Is it me you're looking for?
Is it Lionel or is it Adele? No, no. So I did them. I did them tracks on Bingo, and then. So you had 2001, 2002.
So Bingo had been going for a few years now.
It started in 2001, I think. 2000, right. 2001.
And that's just you?
That was just me on my own, yeah.
So now you're a label runner focused on...
Yeah, at what point did you stop looking inwardly and start looking towards other people and towards developing talent and being an A&R yourself and getting talent?
I think when I was on Players, I remember there was a few times where there would be tracks that I liked and Hype didn't like, or vice versa. And I think I was starting to get my own sense of what I was really into. And there was, there was a couple of tracks that I thought I would put this out if I had a label, and I didn't have a label. And so then when I did the 138 trick, it seemed like a sort of good point at which to start doing my own thing. And Hype had Ganja Records and Pascal had Frontline Records, so it felt like it's okay to do that. So I started doing that, and I think the first act that I signed was Chasing Status. I think they're the first ones.
That's what I love about this show. We got Mike Pickering in here, and I find out to my absolute astonishment that he'd signed the Happy Mondays, and same. With this, I had no idea that you were the first person that was on Chasing Status.
Yeah, I think they might have had one released before or something, but this is certainly one of their earliest ones. But I'll play the track that I signed from them. This is called Wise Up, and this was on Bingo Beats. Here we go. This is Chasing Status, Wise Up.
Trailblazers, DJ Zinc.
Oh, so Chasing Status on Bingo Beats.
Yes, Chasing Status on Bingo Beats. Yes, I put out their track, and Brocky did a 138 BPM thing that I put out as well.
Brocky.
Indeed, yes. And I just can't go into a supermarket and look at broccoli without saying broccoli.
Broccoli.
There we are. Just can't do it.
I'm the same.
So how did you find that? How did you come to sign Chasing Status?
I think that I was at a Forward Club night, and they had a dub plate of it, and they gave it to me. So I guess they were influenced.
Were they still like
it? Yeah, it has your house style, doesn't it? It's very Bingo Beats house style.
Yeah, there was a... at that time, I'd come across this style or done this thing and done a few versions of it. So there was a few other people that were kind of influenced by it, I guess, and doing their own take on it.
And they were sort of just out of uni at that point, I guess? Because 2003...
I think this is before they was... This is when they were at uni still, because I remember going and playing in Manchester, and they were in uni, I think.
Right. And then they came along.
I remember playing somewhere and they were there.
Early.
So they did a few other tracks on Bingo over the years. They did some drum and bass. And
just out of interest, did you feel that they would go on to achieve what they've gone on to achieve at that point? Were you like, you know what, these kids are really... I've really got something special, or was
well,
it more like?
I don't think not yes or no. Really, I didn't have any. I wouldn't say thick, but I think I'm. I just don't really clock stuff like that. I'm more sort of, I hear the track and think, oh, I like that track. I'll put it out.
Yes,
I'm not really. I don't really have a crystal. I'm not a sort of person that.
Well, nobody
is
does.
Good at plan.
Shoot from the hip.
I'm not so good at planning and all that sort of stuff. I'm more like just crack on.
Your successes though, you know, have shown some of that though, because you know the way, like, yeah, a bit of a weird bonus track, what have you, and suddenly that track was incredibly
exactly.
So that shows, even in your own world, you don't necessarily know what is going to blow up. Right?
And, you know, I find, you know, more recently working, you know, when or over the years when I've worked with labels, there's two different approaches, and one of them that I like is make a load of tunes, put them out, let people decide what's what.
Yep.
You know, if a tune's good, it's people are going to play it and it will do all right.
Mm-hmm,
the other approach is make a load of tunes and then the people you're working with, let's work out which one we think is the best one. Then we're really going to push that one. And I find that is a little less genuine. I prefer to just, I'd rather, you know, I love the way now you can, with the internet, you can just make a tune and when you're happy with it, you put it on SoundCloud, give it away. I think, great, I love it. But the business people that I work with don't always think it's so great. But but I, you know, for me, as you know, I look at it as art, and I think that putting money with art is not a particularly good thing. I think it's hard to.
But artists have to live.
Yeah, exactly. So, and if you said to me, well, you know, do you want to play at the club? And you can either, we'll give you your bus fare or we'll give you a big fee. I'll take the big fee because, you know, I just will, you know, that's how I am. So I'm not saying that.
And how everybody is, really.
Yeah. So I don't, I don't feel bad about that, but I know that that's basically how it works. But I do get a sense of, I really do like giving music away. And I do find that, I really noticed when there was the transition between, you know, like when it was vinyl, we press it up when we want. We release it when we want. You can have it when we say you can have it. And then with the internet, people are, you know, if something gets played on the radio, somebody will rip it. Somebody will put it on YouTube. If anybody wants to hear it, they can.
Yep.
They can get it. And so all of a sudden, the power's gone from the labels to the public,
to decide,
which is great. I think, you know, which I love, you know,
right.
I think is 90% good. Just making music and releasing it, basically.
And seeing what happens.
And seeing what happens and letting the, you know, letting, if something's going to be successful, let people. I think people are the best judges, really. You know, the only hard thing nowadays is actually getting it to people's ears to let them choose what is what they like. But, so anyway, at the time, Chasing Status, I mean, it was clear that they were good producers.
Yep.
But I would have had no inkling that they were going to go on to do what they did. And it's been really impressive and inspirational watching them do that, you know.
But they're not the only ones, right, that have come through and gone on to do really big things. So did you sign Sigma as well?
Yeah. I released some of their music. I wouldn't say I signed them because, I think that you, like I know you, Nick, have had labels where you sign artists, you develop them, you do this sort of stuff. With me, I was more like, I like that tune, can I put it out? Really... much more basic, less thought out, less considered approach.
But in doing that, you help to incubate these people, which is really important.
I like the way you're on my side here, Eddie. it's a different sort of approach. I think, yes. I don't know if it's that I lack the organisation to sign people and develop them and do that, but or it's just that I just like that particular track they think, and I think I'd like, you know, I would like to put it out.
Yep.
There's a sort of ego thing of like, I want it to be on my label. So there was a few times where there were other labels that wanted to put stuff out, and it was, I thought, I want it, you know. Yeah. And a lot of time I'd hear stuff and I think, I really like this, and I'm not sure if other people will get a chance to hear it if I don't release it. So I'll release it because I like it. So there's an element of both in that. So yeah, I put out some Sigma stuff. And, you know, when
similarly early stages for them,
and,
right?
And,
were they probably at uni as well? They're probably at Leeds, weren't they?
Yeah, I don't
Chasing
know.
Chasing Status at Manchester, yeah. I guess.
I do remember thinking that these guys are similar to Chasing Status. That's the only sort of thing I thought at the time was.
Yes, and you were right.
Yeah, similar kind of thing. They're
smart,
you know,
intelligent.
Smart, yeah. Engaged. So they've done well.
Yeah,
and
man.
So I was releasing some Chasing Status stuff, some Sigma stuff. Around about 2005, 2006, I started to get a bit bored with drum and bass.
So, so what was going through your mind then? What led to that?
What was going
through
my mind? You know, when we were talking about early jungle and, you know, Nick was saying about break beats, where we'd come from, all this stuff. The early jungle music and the rave stuff, everybody that was making this music had come from somewhere else. Some of them come from hip hop, some of them come from ragga, some of them come from classical music, some of them come from different stuff. But because jungle hadn't existed, nobody had already come from it. So everybody brought different samples, different vibes, different all this different stuff. But when it got to a point that drum and bass was basically self-referencing, for me, it just it didn't have that same thing anymore. It just lost some something that, and every track, you know, at the time I remember arguing with some people about it, and pretty much every track that came along was a slightly better produced version of something that had already been done. And I remember, you know, some of the people that we've been talking about today, having the conversation with them, and somebody we were just talking about, who I can't say the name of because we were talking about off air, but I remember him saying, I made this track because I wanted to play so-and-so, but it's not good enough quality, so I just basically did my own new version of it. And then that new version was a massive track, and it's just that he happened to tell me about that, that I know about it. But that's how it kind of felt with a lot of drum and bass. It was, a lot of it sounded like a slightly better version of something I've heard before. There wasn't any, the progression or the sort of weird, the sort of left field bits and pieces that would come. And so
it's sort of eating itself
exactly,
up.
It's self-referencing.
The snake was eating its own tail.
Exactly. So, okay. So the people that were making it had now grown up on it. And so, you know, I think if you look at Pendulum, they had come from rock. So they were another one, like where Optical came along and he kicked everyone up the arse. Pendulum came along and kicked everyone up the arse with a new sort of sonic, this new sound. And I really like that. You know, I love that. But there seemed to be with drum and bass round about 2005, 2006, that it was getting a bit samey for me. And so I said to my agent, I said, I want to see if I can start playing a mixed set. And he was like, you're brave, Ben. Okay. So I said, can you put together a tour where I play some house, some breakbeat, some dubstep and some drum and bass all in one set? And this was 2006. This is when drum and bass, when dubstep was just starting.
Yeah.
And so he said, yeah, I'll do it. So I got this tour and he put this tour together. And when in practice, it didn't really work because people didn't want to hear different music in the same night at that time in the clubs that I was playing. Nowadays, they do. And, you know, people like Annie Mac came along and she did a great job of mixing it up. And now, and you know, I think it was just a bit too early for that, because the people that were into drum and bass just wouldn't dance till the end. And the people that were into house would dance and then they'd stop when it changed. It just didn't work at the time. It worked for me. I thought, this is great. This is all this music mixed up and I'm going to build it up in speed and it's going to be like really cool. And people were just like, sorry, mate. We only like this. Like that.
It's pretty depressing, isn't it, hear that? Because I love going to a night that covers multiple sort of music bases. There's good music and there's bad music.
I think, yeah, this is more a time when people were being into one thing, though. You know, and I remember when I was buying records, you had to spend a lot of time and money following one scene. You couldn't follow four or five. It didn't really work.
Okay.
No, I need to hear the violin. Shed a little tear. But a couple of weeks before I was going to do this tour, I thought, right, I'm going to do this tour where I'm going to play a mix of music, better buy some house to play that I like. Went on to Beatport, couldn't find any house. I thought, I want to hear stuff like, you know, like UK Garage, but so it's got bass lines, house, bit funky, you know, but sort of the UK element. And I just couldn't find it. I was like, this is unbelievable. You know, I used to listen to this music in the 88, 89, 90, where it was 4/4, there was bass lines, there was samples or whatever, you know, it existed then, but I just couldn't find it at all. So I did this tour, but what that put in my head was I thought, I want to hear house with bass lines in it.
And not 4/4, something with a bit of a rolling beat.
Yeah, and you know. Yeah, like 4/4 though, but 4/4 with bass lines or 4/4 with a break beat on it, but not necessarily two-step. So I started doing, so then I took a year off, and it coincided with when my eldest kid it was the year before he went to school, I took a year off. So I thought, I'll hang out with my kid for a year and I'll stop, mate, you know, I'll have a break from music, from DJing, so that I can then start this new era, you know, this sort of new era. Yeah. Mm. So in that year that I was, I said to my agent, this is the agent that said I was brave for doing the thing. I was like, right, and this is the next brave thing I'm going to do. I'm going to stop playing drum and bass. I'm going to take a year off. And when I start again, I'm going to play music of a scene that doesn't exist yet. And he was like, okay, fucking hell, you really are brave this time, mate. Wow. You're jumping off a cliff and you don't know where you're going to land, but you're going
to... This was your agent covering yourself in petrol and lighting a match.
He was, you know, I've got a different agent now. She's really good. No,
maybe that was what happened. He didn't set fire to himself.
No, but, you know, like, credit to him. He smashed it. He absolutely smashed it. He said, great. You know, he rubbed his hands together. Because I said to him, I'm a bit bored of drum and bass. He's like, I know what you know, he wasn't like, I know what you mean, but he was like, I understand.
Yeah,
you know, he totally understood what I was saying, and he was like, great challenge, let's go, you know, let's rock the boat a bit. And so I took a year off, and when I started DJing again, I started playing house. I was playing house with bass lines. And it was an interesting time. I remember within the year that I took off, I remember hearing the Crookers Essential Mix, and within it, there was a Jack Beats remix of AC Slater, Jack Got Jacked.
Yep.
And that track was, like, to me, it was exactly what I was thinking. I was like, this is fucking unbelievable.
Mm.
And so I phoned up one of the Scratch Perverts, Joel, and, like, I talked to him on the phone now and again. I'm speaking to him. I'm like, mate, I've listened to this song. It's fucking amazing. Check it out. Played it, you know, I'm playing it down the phone to him. And he's like... Yeah. Do you know who made that? I'm like, no. He's like, it's fucking Neil from the other Scratch Pervert.
Yeah.
So it's like a really strange coincidence, but a really nice one. So then, you know, I phoned up Niall. I'm like, fucking, I can't believe you've done this tune, mate. This is amazing. And he was like, yeah, great. You know, there's this sort of new sound, isn't there? And so luckily, I wasn't the only person in the world who was a lot thinking on this lines of like 125, 130 bass, you know, mm-hmm. bass lines stuff. So then, excuse me, so I started DJing again in 2009, playing house with bass. And it was a bit tricky at first, but there was some really good signs. There was a couple of times when I, you know, the first gig I did, which was at Moles in Bath, I was like two records in, and this bloke leans over the counter, he's like, what the fuck is this, man? And he's like, right, ragged looking dude with like half a beard, and his hair was all over the place. Looked like he'd just come off of a farm or something. And he was like, what the fuck is this? What is this, man? So I said, oh, this is what I play now. And he was like, this is fucking shit, man. Where's the drum and bass? This is fucking shit. And I was like, I'm sorry, mate. This is what I play now. You know, so I was a bit like, fucking hell, it wasn't quite the intro that I had in mind.
I'm playing Moles tomorrow. I'll watch out for that guy.
Yeah. So I was thinking, this isn't exactly the intro I had in mind, but you know, fuck it. You know, I'd crack on. And then, about 10 minutes before the end of a set, I'd done one track called Killer Sound, and it had been played on radio a little bit. And this really attractive young woman come up to me and goes, have you played Killer Sound yet? So I said, no. She said, I fucking love it. I can't believe it. It's amazing. It's like totally different sound. I love it. It's great. And I thought,
Bristol accent, Bath accent, yeah.
I thought, thank you. Thank you, God. Or, you know, or whatever, you know, thank you, universe, whatever it is.
Yeah.
That was a really nice sign that the dude that is a bit weird doesn't like it, and the chick that's really cool does like it.
Yeah.
And so there was quite a few things like that when people were, you know, the sort of some people were like, oh, this is fucking, what are you doing? You're a fucking traitor. This is shit. And then within the same hour, there'd be somebody else would be like, this is fucking amazing. I've never heard anything like it.
Yeah. Without conflict,
amazing.
Without conflict, there is no progress.
Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah. So it was a bit tricky when I did that. I did these crack house EPs. I was with Dynamite in Japan, and this is before I did my first house gig. I went and played in Japan with Dynamite, and I was saying like, we've got to say something. You've got to intro it. Let people know that I'm not playing drum and bass. I'm going to play house, and I ended up playing. You know, I played some jungle in that set, but. I was saying, we were sitting in the bar before the gig, and I was saying, we need to call it something. We need to have a name that is like, if you say house, people think, oh, I know what that is. And on the wall, it said crack house. Either he or me said, how about crack house? I was like, yeah, right, cool, fuck it. And so that was it. So then he was like, this is a new sound. It's called crack house. You know, and it could have been some totally random thing if it had been something else on the wall. It just happened to be that. And so then I started doing these crack house EPs, and they're basically, you know, 8 tracks or whatever of house with bass. And I remember when I was working on some of this stuff at first, the manager of a big house DJ coming and sitting in my studio, because 360, who are a big management company, were in the office above my studio. And this big manager, who's a really nice guy, you know, I really like him. He came and listened to some of the stuff I was working on, and he was like, bass lines in house, mate, I just can't see it happening. Like, it's just, I can't see it. And then 2 or 3 years later, he was like, fucking hell, mate, you was fucking...
Yeah, bass line.
Yeah,
house,
I missed that
huge,
one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, yeah, so one of the tracks I did was called Blunt Edge, and it was an instrumental track. And it was called Blunt Edge because when I made it, my management people said, it's all right, but it's not very cutting edge, is it? So I said, all right, I'll call it Blunt Edge then. And so, so I called it Blunt Edge, and I put it out and did pretty good. And then we decided to put Miss Dynamite on it. And so it became Wild Out. And so this is DJ Zinc, me featuring Miss Dynamite, Wild Out, aka Blunt Edge, because it's not very cutting edge.
Trailblazers, DJ Zinc. If a man wild out, bungalow, bad boy, girl, wild out. If a vet wild out, the mother pet pocket set wild out. If a hat wild out, right or not, don't stop wild out. One get clean, make a scene wild out, and then embarrass them, go scream and shout at him. If a man wild out, bungalow, bad boy, girl, wild out. If a vet wild out, the mother pet pocket set wild out. If a hat wild out, right or not, don't stop wild out. One get clean, make a scene wild out, and then embarrass them, go scream and shout at him.
Already played one of the greatest tracks ever made, and there's another one. Oh, utterly brilliant. Never ever get tired of that. Wild Out, Zinc, and Dynamite.
Big up, Miss Dynamite.
And yeah, absolutely, Naomi. Really. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Brilliant.
Great example of take a track, put a vocal on it, and like take it to a totally another level.
Yeah, really.
She
really
smashed it, didn't
totally
she?
Absolutely smashed it out of the park into another postcode.
Yes.
Well, we've run out of time, Ben.
And dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. So, like, very quickly, like, what's on the horizon for you? You know, you've always been ahead of the game. What's the next game?
Currently, I have the stuff I've got lined up at the minute. I guess it will depend on when this is going to be broadcast. But the stuff that I'm, as we're recording this, working on, I've got a track coming out with a guy called Boy Matthews. And the track's called This Time, which is house with bass still. So it's got a break beat in it as well. So where my head is at right now at the start of 2016 is break beats again, basically. Mm-hmm. I've been doing the house for a while. I've been starting to introduce break beats more into what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I really, you know, I like break beats. I really do like break beats. You know, there's just something about it. There's a life in it. You know, I make stuff like that, you know, Wild Out is all drum machines, and there's not any breakbeat in it. I don't think there's a few sample percussion stuff, but when I start using breakbeats again, there's something about it that I love. You know, you're sort of dragging this thing from another era. It's like a time machine. You're bringing this thing that's just got soul. It's like the analog equipment. It just has this soul that you just can't. You know, it's got the soul of the geezer who's playing the drums. It's essentially, I guess, that's what it is.
Yeah,
it's got this thing, this sound, this thing that I just love. I can't get, you know, I'll never tire of it. I love it.
And it's the wheel turning full circle, because that's where your soul is. That's where this whole conversation started.
Yeah.
Was on breakbeats.
Yeah.
Was just the...
Exactly, yeah. So I'm still, you know, I was in the studio today working on a track with two breakbeats in it, and I love it. I think, you know, sometimes I think, fucking one trick pony, or, you know, am I never going to progress to anything? You know, I listen to new, you know, a lot of new music, and I like it. And then I go in the studio and do something that sounds like it could have been made 20 years ago or 30, you know, years and years ago, 20 years ago. And, but I like it. And I think I'm just going to do what I like. I, you know, when I was making music, I think, you know, maybe in the late 90s, sometimes I tried to make tracks that would fit in with certain DJ sets. And what I found is, actually, when I thought, sod that, I'm just going to make something for myself, that's the one that always works, basically. So
yeah, that's the perfect motivation.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, and I tell you what, it's such an easy thing as well. It's like when I'm in a club, I think, what should I play? I play what I would want to hear. When I'm on radio, what should I play? What I would want to hear if I turn the radio on. What should I go in the studio? What should I make? What I would want to receive. You know, what a great motivation for making tunes is going through promos and thinking, fucking can't find anything I like. Go and make it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So I don't know. In some ways, it's kind of limiting, because it's going to be continually just doing the same thing. But I love it, you know, and it works, and it's the real me, and it's
yeah, and you're still shooting from the hip, aren't you?
Yeah,
you're
I'm happy.
That super,
I'm
super sharp shooter. You're following your gut. You're such
exactly.
a gut.
Yeah,
you know, player, aren't you?
Yeah, and you know, I've been doing interviews for years and years and years, and what I've always said, you know, people always said, "What have you got coming up? And what are you going to be doing? And what do you hope for the next year?" And what I've always said, but only recently realised what it means. What I always used to say is, if I'm doing this time next year, I'll be over the moon. And I thought like, it's because I'm worried that I'm going to be going back to the crappy office. But actually, what it means is I'm happy right now. And if I am happy now, I'm not waiting for something else to happen and then I'll be happy. It's like today I was in the studio all day, see my kids, hang out. I just love it. And I have been like that for as long as since I've been doing this as a job. And so, it's great what I do. So I think I'm happy. So why fuck with it? Just go and make some more tunes that I would want to hear.
Well, what a trailblazer. Well, we've got to finish off with the way that we finish off every one of these interviews on Trailblazers, which is might be a tough one for you. So the aliens have landed and they've gone, you know, we're building some kind of super highway and we're deciding whether to blow up this planet or that one over there.
So I've got to provide them with a bit of culture that shows so they're worthwhile as a planet.
What would you give them? What would you give them that you think might save the world?
You know what I would play? It's my favourite track of all time, which is Amy Winehouse, Love is a Losing Game. It's because the strings in the end, they just kill me. The strings.
The original or the Moody Boys remix?
No, come on, man. the original. And it's just the strings at the end. Oh, unbelievable. And I think if any aliens decided to blow us up, then fuck them, really. I mean, what do they know? I don't really want to hang about if they're not into that.
Okay.
Fair enough. Amy Winehouse, lovely way to end.
Trailblazers, DJ Zinc.
For you, I was a flame. Love is a losing game. Five-story fire as you came. Love is a losing game.
Deezer. Originals. Trailblazers.
Thanks for your ears. We hope you enjoyed Trailblazers. We love your feedback. So if you want to get in touch with either of us, you can reach out to me via Twitter at EddieTM. That's EDDYTM.
Or you can reach out to myself, Nick Hawkes, NickHalkes on Twitter or Facebook. And remember, we've just given you a taste of the great music that shaped the journey of our special guest today. If you want to hear music in full, head over to Deezer.com and you can find special Trailblazers playlists that Eddie and I put together and some special stuff from our guests.
And bear in mind that if you enjoyed this stuff on Trailblazers, you'll definitely enjoy the curated playlists that happen on Deezer.
Just download the app for free and search for Trailblazers or head to the dance section,
where you'll find a playlist for just about any genre you can think of in dance.
Trailblazers.
Thank you so much to DJ Zinc for joining us.
And next time on Trailblazers, the legendary Renate van der Papillière.
Deezer. Originals.